Next up, we have Bill Shirk, our own, who we can never say enough nice things about. Honored with a named grant, he's recognized for his important work and contributions in the field. I think we would all say that he personifies the excitement, the passion, the professionalism of archival collection and the preservation of sound recordings. Currently, he serves on the editorial board for Popular Music and Society, and he's responsible now for making the Bowling Green University Collection the largest university collection in the country with over 700,000...
Million.
Million? Oh, 7 million?
7 million. No, a million.
Oh, okay. Now they keep rolling in with over a million. Here's Bill Shirk.
Sing them here. But that was the Billboard March, as composed by Cincinnati-born composer John Nicholas Klor, who was born in 1869, but he was born in Cincinnati in 1869 and died in 1956. And this, the Billboard March, was his most famous composition. And of course, at first I was going to play songs, and I said, boy, it's going to take away from a real cool presentation right now. And also, I want to make sure we cover as much information as possible, because this has been fun for me, and I want to hope that it's going to be just as much fun for you. Once I started at Bowling Green State University in 67, we started a subscription to Billboard, but earlier on, I became familiar with Billboard magazine. Once we started our subscription and many other subscriptions, I made a point of looking at every periodical that ever came in, because you have to be aware when you're a librarian, right? If you're a librarian, you've got to know everything about everything, and if you don't, you're lost. So Billboard told me everything about everything every week. And that's the point I want to make, is that when I'm going to start talking about this magazine, you're going to learn everything about everything from 40 years ago today in the world of popular music. And time passes so fast when you're having fun. I think it was the late 1980s, I wrote one of six essays in a larger work, which had now become a standard publication on international music periodicals, and one of my chapters was Billboard. Now, is there anybody that has never heard or used Billboard? Are there people? Come on, don't lie. I see someone that's not lying. Good, good, good. Okay, what I wanted to do is read you, and this course is not going to be plagiarism, because these are my words, okay? My words for this beginning of this essay, and I think this will just kind of set the stage. I usually never like to read, never, but I'm going to do it today. The best information available indicates that Billboard was founded in Weilert's Saloon on Vine Street in Cincinnati over two glasses of beer. Boy, I'm glad it wasn't over more beer. Shared by William H. Donaldson and James F. Hennigan. The idea for the journal originated with Donaldson, who theorized that those in the entertainment promotion industries, many of whom traveled constantly, would appreciate a magazine that would enable them to keep in touch with one another, thus the word billboard. The cover of the first issue of what was originally called Billboard Advertising carried the following slogan, a monthly resume of all that is new, bright, and interesting on the boards. Donaldson, its first editor, explained that the publication would be devoted to the interests of the advertisers, poster printers, bill posters, advertising agents, and secretaries of fairs. In its first issue, Billboard Advertising declared the following editorial policy. We will carefully canvass the field we have entered, ascertain its needs and requirements, and ground ourselves thoroughly in the principles of a policy that will enable us to best achieve our aim. And that's sort of like the platform we're going to shoot across to find out what was happening March 29th, 1968. Just a teeny kind of weeper anecdote. I was originally supposed to give this presentation at the Chapel Hill meeting a number of years ago. I have now lost count but I had a little bit of a bodily misfunction and I wasn't able to give the presentation, and without using that weepiness, I was happily, accepted to give this presentation now, and I promise I won't again do any more weepiness. So what I've done with Billboard magazine, I have given you a handout which you can caress, you can read on the flight going back home. It's just a little bit of remembrance of this presentation, and you get a little bit of an indication of what Billboard was all about. And hopefully this will encourage you to do what I have done. What I've done is broken down the magazine according to the different types of things that they covered in the magazine. And some of these will ring a bell historically, or they were part of your life. Judging from the wide range of ages I see here, some of them, it will strike a magic chord. Others will say, what? So what I'm going to do first is talk about and reiterate some of the articles related to very specific record labels. Number one, Bill Cosby's new label, Tetragrammaton Records, was leased a 60-foot yacht, and it was named Fat Albert. And of course, we can all relate to Fat Albert. And it was named after the label's first single, because there was a single called Fat Albert, but it was, of course, also named after the sort of autobiographical cartoon character. And it was moored across from the NARM, NARM, National Association of Record Merchandisers, Convention Arena in Hollywood, Florida, because it was organized, the label was organized too late to register for the NARM meeting. Okay, that's Tetragrammaton. And hopefully some people remember what Tetragrammaton album in the United States related to the Beatles was very, very popular, or not popular, right? The Two Virgins album sold with the brown bag cover so we wouldn't see John and Yoko's parts. Atlantic Records is to release its first CSG LPs in April. It was touting their new CSG stereo process. It was introduced by Howard Holzer and is said to eliminate the need for mono singles to be issued separately from stereo singles, so they would be mono/stereo singles. They also issued albums in the same new format. Harmony Records, we all adore Columbia's wonderful budget label. It launched a 3-month promotional campaign, and it was featuring reissues. It was primarily a reissue label, but it did issue some new material. They were issuing new reissues of Stonewall Jackson, Steve Lawrence, Lefty Frizzell, Norman Lubroff Choir, and Mike Douglas, plus Frank Sinatra, Doris Day, Mitch Miller, Ray Price, and our old buddy Liberace. P. Peter Rapp, now this is where these little articles will really give you an insight into the history of these companies, and you may never find it anywhere else. How many of you ever heard of Peter Rabbit Records? Peter Rabbit Records label to be introduced by Budget Sound Incorporated out of LA. They were going to issue a run of 13 children's records, and they announced that the holding company for Peter Rabbit was the same company that makes Somerset, we've heard of Somerset, Stereo Fidelity, Owlshire Records, and Audio Spectrum. RCA was offering a bonus LP by Peter Ustinov in an April 3 disc set by the Boston Symphony Chamber Players, featuring music by Mozart, Brahms, Schubert, Poulenc, and others. And what it was featuring was a separate disc of Ustinov describing the compositions. I mean, talk about a lot of nice collectibles here. United Artists, and every not every issue of Billboard, but many of the issues of Billboard would feature a celebration of the anniversary of a specific record label or record company, or maybe anniversary of in the life of a particular recording star. This issue featured a celebration of the 10th anniversary of United Artists. And when Billboard does this, it's a wonderful insert because you are then getting a great history of the United Artists label, plus a history of its various subsidiaries at that time. And the subsidiaries at that time, and I'm sure many of you would be hard-pressed to name those subsidiaries. Tailspinners, which was a children's label. UA International, which self-explanatory, UA Latino. Solid State, which was a jazz-based label. And Veep, which was its soul arm. In addition, of course, if you ever read Variety magazine, when you have these celebratory articles and sections, you have everybody and his grandmother congratulating in full page, depending on who loved them the most and who has the most money. You have everywhere from a quarter page up to a full page of somebody or some label congratulating. So you have a wonderful, you know, list of congratulatory advertisements in this insert into this issue. Barclay label out of France was recently launched a six-track mini LP in France, and now has issued the first mini compatible mono stereo, just like the CSG of Atlantic, stereo EP by guitarist Michel Dintrec. And it was issued on yellow plastic, and in the United States, you could buy it for $1.99. Jubilee Records. Who hasn't heard of Jubilee Records? And who is probably the most famous of all Jubilee artists? But Rusty Warren, Lusty Busty, Rusty Warren, her famous Knockers Up. 6 million in comedy LPs over the last 15 years. Rusty Warren with 9 LPs, Knockers Up, 181-week charting LP, and Jubilee was known, of course, because they had Rusty Warren for its liberal attitudes. And more women in the audience actually bought the records than males. And they depended a lot on mail order to market their recordings and played a big part in their sales. And here's something I didn't know. One of my most favorite labels called Gross Records. Gross Records is a label that had only one artist on it. Doug Clark and his Hot Nuts. And I'm not even going to go describe of the various levels of public performance that he would go through. I did not know that Gross Records was a subsidiary of Jubilee Records. And of course, even maybe more famous than Rusty Warren, all the Kermit Schaefer, pardon my blooper records. Hey, aren't we all in love with those fake recordings of Kermit Schaefer? And last but not least in the label category, if you remember that we just heard a paper just recently on Hip Pocket Records, well, the Hip Pocket Records, the Philco Ford product, It is lowering its price from 69 to 39 cents. And after the price drop, sales increased tremendously. See what I mean about this magazine? We've learned about these record labels, little bits and pieces. And you know what? The week before and the week after, they're not going to talk about them. It's that issue that they're talking about. So you have to pick up an issue and you read it. What was hard enough for me, I looked at the issue just before this. I said, boy, I wish I would have had this one instead. You know what? Too bad. You know, you got me for this time and that's it. Then, of course, performers and performances were covered very heavily in Billboard magazine, both information about the performers and their contracts and you know, their lives on the road. They also reviewed public performances, usually something that weren't concerts, but most of the time they were concerts. Spanky and Our Gang off on a two-week promotional European tour. And it says it was starting in Paris to showcase their new single, which was a hit, Like to Get to Know You, on Mercury. And all, they were also releasing an LP, but it was not a concert tour. It was just a promotion tour. And also they were appearing on promotional television appearances. Country spawns tycoon artists. We know all of these country artists that have been so rich, they have no idea what they're gonna do with all their money. But it kind of like spotlighted one major artist, our friend Whispering Bill Anderson, who has diversified, you know, all of his musical talents to have all types of holdings in not only performance, but performing venues and all other types of money-making ventures to make him, you know, a multi-millionaire. And then in the same breath, they mention our good friend Porter Wagoner, our good friend, the late Porter Wagoner, as someone who is sort of like pulling on the coattails of success that that Bill Anderson is. Flatten Scruggs, Lester Flatten, Earl Scruggs, back from mob producing shows in Japan. They were greeted by a press party at Nashville, at the Nashville Municipal Airport. And according to the way they described their Japanese visit, it was like a Beatles concert. They said it was mayhem. They said the Japanese are the Japanese audiences and the fans, I mean, almost made it impossible for Flatten Scruggs to move about after their concerts. They were just so enamored and so crazy for the duo and the, you know, their musical group. Decca's Irish Rovers, kind of like picking up the baton of Tommy Clancy and, you know, and their whole gang. But Irish Rovers on Decca surprised chart washer watching their charts with their hit tune,
Unicorn.
The Unicorn, written by
Shel Silverstein.
There we go. See, we have a little bit of quiz here, right? Written by Silverstein. So there, and they were, of course, citizens of what country? Canada. Okay. Sometimes that's all you get in the article, but you know, that's a nice little bit. Glenn Campbell of Capitol Records delighted an audience at his opening at the Nashville Room. He was praised for his singing and his humor. All right. And the highlight was, by the time I get to Phoenix, and he sang 20 songs, and he did jokes. And you know, can you imagine a little comedy act of Glenn? Benny Goodman in his octet and concert orchestra with the Philadelphia Chamber Symphony at the New York Philharmonic Hall, and his septet was added by the appearance of Zoot Sims on saxophone, and then when the orchestra conducted by Anshel Brusilov, now see, they get these classical people, I don't know how to pronounce all their names, along with soprano Licia Albanese, there you go. Letterman piling up. Didn't we see the Letterman on the Beatles? Didn't we really see them? Or the four freshmen, that some of the harmonies that they were doing? Letterman piling up nightclub offers. Hit single has generated interest. And this is the best part of all. They appeared at Leo's Casino in Cleveland. I never went there. My buddies went there. I don't know why I didn't. But Leo's Casino was exclusively a black act nightclub. Letterman appeared as the first white act at you know, at Leo's Casino. Eric Burden and the Animals, recording for MGM Records, review of a concert at New York's Anderson Theater, and their hits that they sang at this concert were Painted Black, House of the Rising Sun, Sky Pilot, and in the background they had all the psychedelic, you know, remember you see the Iron Butterfly concert, and in the background they had images of World War II planes and Hitler. So that was a very special performance. They have others. I want to make sure that we cover everything here. Alrighty. The next category are the full-page ads. I mean, this was a wonderful platform for advertising everything under the sun related to popular music and recordings. They carried ads that were the little bitty insert ads all the way to full-page and double-spread ads. You have examples of some of these in the handout. And the full-page ads in this magazine included Jefferson Airplane's ad for, and sometimes it was a full-page ad only for a single that never went anywhere. You know, they certainly spent a lot of money advertising. And it included Jefferson Airplane's ad for their single Greasy Heart and share a Little Joke. And Percy Faith's For Those in Love. Now, how many of them do we really remember of those? The Fireballs, rock and roll New Mexico group going away from their best-selling Atco album. Sly and the Family Stone, which we see in your little handout. Dance to the Music LP, which of course was a blockbuster. And of course, there's a renewed interest in Sly, and there's a new set of reissues, remastered recordings of Sly. Johnny Rivers, Look to Your Soul, Imperial single. And then there was this is really funny, the way they number their pages. If you turn your pages, and there was the poster stuck in the middle. And I looked on both sides, and it jumped from page 12 to page 25. And I says, what's this all about? Well, the insert for the Lee Hazelwood, Nancy Sinatra album was in there folded. And every fold was two pages. So you counted two pages, all the way through. And I was worried. I said, oh my God, somebody, you know, desecrated our magazine. But they didn't. It was all those little pages in that fold of that poster were there. And then, of course, Herb Alpert in his Tijuana Tijuana Brass with his Slick and Cabaret, which was one of his blockbuster hits, 45. And then, I think I've included this in your handout, Decca Home Entertainment Products. They were hawking a guitar beginner set with steel strings, picks, polishing cloth, and you also got a guitar strap and a carrying bag and instruction book for $27.50. Boy, how great can it be? The issue before had the article announcing it. So the next issue, which was our issue, see, I call it our issue, isn't it? You feel it? Our issue, hug these words, okay? Our issue included the big ad, and so you'll be able to see that. United Artists section, of course, which I already have mentioned, and then the full-page ad for another one. If you all remember the Herb Alpert Whipped Cream album and the illustration on that, this other one probably matches it almost. It's the Love is Blue Paul Mauriat album on Philips. That image is also probably embedded in millions and millions of males' brains. And then we have the business of records. The business of records, what was happening in conducting the business. The first one, of course, was the announcement and coverage with photos of everybody standing up and hugging each other and holding glasses of who knows what, you know, and look at all these pictures. You have no idea who all these people are. Of the NARM annual meeting in Hollywood, Florida, with articles and pictures. And then there's an article about Columbia Records' Rock Machine promotion campaign. And that was being heralded as one of the label's most successful promotions. new artists and release will spark sales in their catalog, and they will be introducing 35 new LPs. The campaign received a merit award from the Sign and Display Industry magazine for the efforts that they did to promote this campaign. And in my favorite of all, something that undoubtedly is quite cool, but I've never seen them, they were introducing a Premier Talent Marketing Dolls, Showbiz Babies. These are 6-inch doll replicas of recording artists packaged with a 45 RPM single in with bio recorded by a New York City disc jockey. It includes artists like Gary Stevens, Mitch Ryder, Monkees, Bobby Gentry, Peter Noon, and Eric Burden. And they also had included a psychedelic banana bar, a bar shaped to resemble an artist. And they also had 3D buttons and jewelry. Have any of you ever seen those dolls? Somebody saw a bobblehead doll of somebody, but it wasn't you. A bobblehead. And you weren't shaped like a banana, like a banana bar. No. No banana bar. Okay. Technology. This gets really cool. At NARM meeting, discussion on standardization of cartridges. And when you speak of cartridges back then, it was spelled capital C, capital A, capital R, cartridges. And that was because it included both cassettes and 8-tracks. And the tape cartridge department, in they had a separate department for tape cartridges. And they were discussing the cassette's use as off-the-air dubbing as a hit. Hey, don't we know about that? And this is in 1969. Cassette units snap camera stores action. And it was reported from one store in Minneapolis. But many of these camera stores and many stores carried, you know, cassettes and cassette players. And then the NARM cartridge seminar was the top puller. So you like variety, you have these little in words. It was a top puller. It means that, you know, of course, that there was a high attendance and heavy interest in the cartridges. And then it said another statement article was related to Capitol Records considering issuing cassettes, and also that they were considering using vending machines to sell cassettes and cartridges. And musical instruments and sound systems discussed such information as radio, TV programming, progressive rock with radio stations that were stepping forward and playing rock music as a major format rather than maybe only inserting some easy listening and pop music, that they were actually mostly college radio stations were moving into the progressive rock formatting. They had also had columns on classical music, country music, international news reports, and audio retailing. And a couple of the other coverages related to hardware stores, again related to the cassette players being sold in camera stores. Hardware stores cut out a share of the tape business. Superscope embarks on dealer education drive. Is TV's loss audio's gain? Where have we heard that before? Bigger sale for personal portables in Motorola line, and Switchcraft out with a new catalog. We're all pleased with that. And of course, two of the major segments of Billboard magazine included not only the announcement of newly released albums, which I have an example in your handout, and they would also have little squib reviews, and the more important the album would deserve a picture of that record cover in the coverage. But they also had charts, and this is where the popularity charts have been the calling card of Billboard. Ever since, 1940 was the first year that they carried the popularity singles charts for recordings. Joel Whitburn, known to many of us as the person who has compiled a number of chart books of the Billboard charted positions, made the mistake of creating his own charted positions in one of his books for all songs between the 1890 and 1940. We'll say that it has been, the hull of that ship has been pierced fiercely. He made up all of his information. All of it. And the shame of it is scholars still use it today, quoting charted positions for Al Jolson recordings, Frank Frumet recordings. Billy Murray, how many number one records did Billy Murray have? Trying to remember. It was probably fighting again with Fanny Bryce, you know, for some position. You know, who covered who, you know, fight. But the charts that were included in Bill, and they have changed over the years, depending on the format and the musical style and in the way we view the various forms of music. As of April of 1969, you had best-selling classical LPs, best-selling jazz LPs, hot country albums, top LPs, best-selling R&B records, hits of the world, hot country singles, hot 100, and then top 40 easy listening. And for your pleasure, I will tell you the number one hit in each one of those categories and see how many of these you can recall. Best-selling classical LP, Verdi. Now here's where I had to look up names, because Verdi, I knew him. Ernani, an opera called Ernani, and featuring Leontine Price. There we go. I had to call up our printout. What's his name now? Carlo Borgonzi, various artists, RCA Italiana Orchestra with, what's his name? Shippers, Thomas Shippers. Number one on the charts, and it was fighting for position every week. Best-selling jazz LP, A Day in the Life with Wes Montgomery, jazz guitarist on A&M Records. And the previous week was number one, and it was on the charts for 26 weeks. And the last week it was number 28. So it was rising in its position on the charts. Best-selling R&B single record, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by our good friend Otis Redding. Volt Records last week, number two, and it was number one this week, and it was on the charts for 9 weeks. Hot Country Album LP, It Takes People Like You to Make People Like Me. Who did it? Buck Owens and his Buckaroos. On Capitol Records, it was number one last week, and it was number one this week, and it was on the charts for 11 weeks. By the time you get up to the number one, you're usually going to find albums that have been on the charts for a while. Hot Country Singles, another Capitol artist, Sonny James, doing World of Our Own. Last week was number one, this week number one, 11 weeks on the charts. And Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was also number one on the Hot 100. Now that's the one I've included on the back of your handout that seems to have some strange smearing of our Xerox powder. I don't know what happened there. on the Volt record label, last week it was number one. Two, and here they list the weeks. 3 weeks ago it was number one. 2 weeks ago it was number one. And this week it was number one. It was on the charts for 10 weeks. A blockbuster. How am I doing? Oh, okay, I've got it going there. Good. Perfect. Love is Blue, Paul Mauriette and his orchestra on Philips, top 40 easy listening LP. It was on the charts of number two, one last week, and it was number one this week, 16 weeks on the charts. And the album was called Blooming Hits. That was the top LP, Paul Mauriette and his orchestra. Let me tell you, and For LPs, they list all the formats. Weren't you lucky? You could buy on LP, 8-track, 4-track, cassette, or reel-to-reel, or all of them if you so chose. As you can see, and this is just the large information, the stuff that stuck out, but if you want to really get into this magazine, pick up any issue, sit down, and just pour over it. You know, you'll have dreams about it. Dreams. Are we dreaming? Dream on. All right. Well, I think that I've covered everything that I really wanted to do. It was perfect timing. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah?
Just to say that there's a big market now for the ads in Billboard.
Oh, I mean, it's ripped out pages.
It's very hard to find complete intact issues now.
Yeah.
People tend to rip them out and sell them for 10, 20 bucks or
yeah.
more.
Like the Rolling Stone ad for Black and Blue, because it was never allowed to be put on the album, but they ran the ad in the trade journals, which at the time Billboard was running in competition with the other two trade journals, Cashbox and Record World, both of which have since have fallen by the wayside. So Billboard is the only one that remains. Anybody else have any questions, remarks? I guess I told them everything, right? And if I didn't, you know.
I think they're ready for the test.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone.